Welcome to this event at the Ledbury Poetry Festival. It's lovely to see so many of you here and lovely to see so many people watching us online, we sincerely hope. My name is Jonathan Davidson. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest poet this evening and to chair our event. Before I do this, let me remind you that in case of an emergency, please follow the steward's directions towards the fire escapes. And if you have a mobile phone, we'd be grateful if you turn it off. Which is a better option than having it stamped on, which nobody wants to happen to their mobile phone. That joke never works. I'd like to thank our principal sponsor, Arts Council England, for their support, and also BRM, who is our sponsor of this event. I'm going to give a brief introduction to Don, and then he's going to read. Then we'll have some innocuous conversations, if you weren't even here. And then there'll be an opportunity for him to read again, and then some questions from the audience. So if you do have questions, please be storing them up ready for that moment. So Don hardly needs an introduction, but I'm going to say a few words about him. He was born in Dundee, Scotland, in 1963. His poetry has won many awards, including the Whitbread Poetry Prize, the Geoffrey Faber Memorial Prize, the Costa Poetry Award, all three Forward Prizes, and on two occasions, the T.S. Eliot Prize. He was awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry in 2020. I've said 2029 here. I suspect that's not right, because that year has not yet arrived. But anyway, sometime in the 2020s. He's a Professor Emeritus at the University of St. Andrews, and for over 25 years was Poetry Editor at Picador Macmillan. He also works as a jazz musician. But perhaps most importantly, he is a very interesting poet and writer, and we are here to hear and read from his new collection, The Arctic, but also to note the publication of his memoir, Toy Fights of Boyhood, which we may reference. The Arctic will be on sale at the back of the event, and the memoir is on sale from the Poetry House. So would you please welcome to the stage Don Paterson.
Hi, folks. Lovely to be here. Excuse me while I make my geriatric preparations. This may take some time. I have to find my bits and pieces. So, yeah, as Jonathan says, I think the plan is to... thank you for that generous introduction, by the way. I hoped it would never end. But it has. So I'm going to read poems at you for maybe 15 minutes or so, and then we'll have a chat and then do it again. But as Jonathan says, I'll be reading from I might read one from the previous collection, but this is from a book called The Arctic, which is a sort of a weird book for me. You know, not that my books have any theme. But the point of the Arctic was as kind of an experiment, because I realised, I suppose, as a writer, that I wasn't getting any better, is the truth. Let me explain that remark. It's just I'm not sure writers progress, but I think they like to think they do. And what I realised was that we're all the kind of previous writers, we're all the previous people that we were, all the previous personalities that we thought we'd grown out of are really kind of nested inside us, and can unfortunately, or for better or worse, be reactivated at any point in their lives. You just grow more like a Russian doll, around the last one. So I kind of allowed anyone who wanted to grab the keyboard, to write the poem in this book, So, and some of them were voices that I hadn't heard from in a long while, and indeed had never to hope to hear from again, but they occasionally stepped up. But there are a few poems at the start for my father, Russell Paterson, who my dad died of dementia about 4 years ago now, which is a situation a lot of us are now facing as we live to be older, and sometimes perhaps just a little bit too long. But my dad was a musician, so some of the poems reference that. And the fact that, it's a cliche about dementia, which is that music is one of the last things to go. I can verify that. It just seems to kind of pay its line that little bit deeper down into the hippocampus, and you could remember tunes when he'd forgotten everyone's name. You could still remember what guitar he was playing in any given year, He knew it was I was his son, thank God, but he didn't know which one. But if you said 1965, he'd go, "I was playing an Epiphone in 1965. He knew his guitar that he was playing then. And his recall for you know, for old tunes was kind of remarkable, but it sort of dwindled. So the first poem in the book is really about the business of repertoire and about the last tunes that he could remember how to play. He was a country and western musician. He played bluegrass music. And also about, I think, what he taught me about art. There's a big word. And it's called repertoire. The last few times he dragged his box along to the folk club upstairs at the Brigitte, until the night the stairs turned him away, he told me he could get right through a song by forgetting his hands and fixing on the space above the sea line, so its empty plane would clear the garbled switchboard in his brain of any tune not soldered into place. In the end, you'd only two left in the book whose names I might be tempted to curate for their piquancy, had he not put me straight. It's not a violin from which I took you play the crowd or play whatever's true. Truck driving man and good old Mountain Dew. I'll have a go at reading this one. That doesn't sound very encouraging. I'll try to read this point for you. It's about my childhood nickname that for years I didn't understand. And I only really understood the word until after my father had died. And that's the title, which is Snabba. A word you might have come across if you happen to be from the northeast of Scotland, but otherwise I think it'll be new to you. Snabba. I hadn't heard the word in 40 years, until then at the ragged hem of sleep, just once in his bedside voice. That word only he would call me by, and only when I was sick or cried out from a dream. Why would he console me with it now? I'd put 3 whole years on that rainy month, his death seemed almost lost in all the trouble. Why so out of time? Although the dead don't know to keep the order of our days. But perhaps one doesn't ever really mourn those obliged to leave us by degrees. Our last tears are relief, if there are any. The blessing of a death to take him clean was denied that man of purely good intention who left us through a puncture in his side, a slow leak hissing all that made him him, I will say soul, back to the receiving dark from which it first had calved, then found its host. It was a stronger vessel than he needed. His sickness was a stair into a cellar where not one thing had edge enough to name, but the steps were shallow and he took them slow, so mostly I was dead to it, and dry-eyed, bar perhaps the last time he restrung his good guitar, and everything was backwards and upside down, and him weeping in anger. Oh, Dad. But otherwise. Eventually, he slept, if we discount that last astonishment I'd only seen before in the just born. Snabba. From before I could remember, a name so often mine I barely knew it, although all names are strange, so long unused. Back then, all I heard was the love in it, the way his father, too, had called him by the same Mairn's pet word, maybe from the Norse, meaning child or beloved one. The last time I was 16 and shivering and raving in the last bed in the ward when I thought they were all trying to kill me. Snabba, he'd said. Of course, now that it's all I have of him, it's so obvious, I could laugh. Snabba, snowball. That was all he was calling me in his own childhood Scots. And now the boy with the white hair and the white beard holds his knees and makes himself very small and round because now he is very cold and he has no father. I did something, this is may sound rather perverse or weird, but I did something. I was with my dad when he died, and just for a laugh, because you're out of it at that point. You know, I thought, I'll take his pulse, I'll see what's going on here. test. So for the record, when we die, our hearts don't slow like steps or clocks, but whir like small wings in a box now lit up by a crack of sky. Trying to find something cheerier here. There must be something. Wait a minute. Here we go. I'll read one more about my dad. It's a bit more upbeat. My dad was, as I say, a musician, but his great skill was as an accompanist. He was brilliant. And there was no kind of last round Sinatra so bad that my dad didn't seem to know where the guy was going next, you know. And he accompanied some truly terrible singers. And he made them all sound good. And they never knew it was him. They thought it was them. But he just seemed to anticipate any, you know, sort of sudden change of key, you know, into F minus or whatever it was they were heading for, you know, with something like a sixth sense. You know, I never worked out how he managed to do it. But so this is about that, and it's called On Sounding Good, and it's addressed to the worst singer I ever heard my father accompany. On Sounding Good. Sir, know this, that you were utter shite in the Kirkintilloch Social Club that night when at the bidding of your next of kin you rushed the stage and counted yourself in, resolved to give it Laldi, your best shot, all you had and more that you did not, on a number you'd pinpointed in advance with a misplaced yet granitic confidence and a mondegreen of two words which belonged to the chorus of a wholly different song. And yet my father, on your 1-2-3, took one breath to exhume your opening key, then shadowed you, as with Apollo's harp, through your ascent from E-flat to K-sharp. But you barely heard the man with a guitar who guided you towards the final bar and off into the safety of the wing like the Dalai Lama gently shepherding a drunken wasp towards an open window. Nor, as you reached your bestial crescendo, did you see just how his providence had lent the guise of logic to each chance event. A velvet tray of right made for the wrong that was the alien spanners of your song. He did all this because he had an ear like the sea that raised him, open, true, and clear. So on that night, as every night, he chose to make you sound good, or good at least to those who loved you. And since he had love to spare, your knowing this was neither here nor there. I'll read a couple more and... we'll have a wee blether. Some short ones. It's a ballad that I don't fully understand. Maybe you can explain it to me later. Called The Coming War. Oh, darling, do you recollect that bright blue summer's day? You nursed your flat white on the deck of the Riverside Cafe. And at each mild disharmony, I'd try my latest face and tilt my head and close one eye and look off into space, not knowing as I took my stock of all the hidden stars, my sight would always auto-lock on Saturn or on Mars. I'll slip into wee sonnets at this point. I say wee sonnets, but sonnets are all the same length, so the qualifier is redundant. Wee sonnet, big sonnet, there's not much in it, as I say. Jonathan mentioned this point because, when we were talking earlier, because of the title. It's called The Sicilian Advantage, and I should explain, it's my favourite corner of the restaurant, and the Sicilian Advantage is a mafia term. It's where you can see all the exits, you know, and the toilet and the windows, you know. So if anyone's coming for you, at least you'll see them coming, you know. So it's And it's a sort of a short, dramatic monologue, really, in the voice of a really, what I realise is some shadow version of myself, I assume, but a really unpleasant dude who's talking here. The Sicilian advantage. For me, you shouldn't have. No, I mean it. I hate surprises. But this is apropos. Not sure how you knew, but anyways, thank you. Yes, I'm here most nights these days with a house red and a vitello milanese. Don't say creature of habit. It makes it sound lazy. It's an economy. No more for me, no. It's fine. Stop fussing. I'll have Ugo clean it. Yeah, same table, parked here like a rook. Oh, Cont, it's more like my idea of freedom. You remember my bed that one time in the nook, the pillows in the corner? God, no. Never. But tell me about your weekend or whatever. Just keep your hands up here where I can see them. Again, not a poem I fully understand, but it doesn't sound nice. And I'll finish with, this is a version of a poem by Miguel de Unamuno called Atheist Prayer, which is accurately descriptive of the contents. Atheist Prayer. Hear my prayer, O non-existent God, accept these cries into thy nothingness, thou who never leaves poor men unblessed by your false comfort. Your perfect fraud is all I ever yearn for, my old friend. When you withdraw, my memory is assailed by every silly song and fairy tale my mother read to sweeten the day's end. How great you are, my absent God, so rare and boundless, an idea less than air. Oh, look how very thin the world has grown in trying to meet you. For you and you alone I suffer, Lord. For you I die and die. Since where you two exist, then so my eye.
Such a lovely reading. I'm looking at the audience and we're all kind of smiling because you've given us so much through those few poems. I've got many questions I'd like to ask. The first one I'm going to ask is, how important is it for you to have your poems heard? How important is it for you to have them spoken in your own voice? When you're writing, are you imagining a moment like this?
I'm imagining a moment like this, which is different from some of the readings that I might do. You know, when there's the, I don't imagine moments like the reading I did in Aberdeen Arts Centre a few years ago, where there was nobody there at all, and then two people turned up and then sat sort of confused in the front. You know, and I thought of Louis Armstrong. He said, "You don't know how far these two people have come," and I thought, "I'll just do the show anyway." You know, and I started this, and I read a poem. And I paused, and the guy leant in and he said, "This isn't the Chrysanthemum and Dahlia Society, is it?" So I imagine this, you know. But no, the truth is, I write for the page, because of that, I suppose at the end of the day, readings really are glorified sales pitches for the book, is the truth. But of course, you read it as a verbal construction, and you read it in the hope that even in the reader's head, it'll hit the air, you know, and you practice these poems against the air when you're reading them, you know. I definitely don't hear them in my own voice. I think some of them are and some of them less so, but it's not important that the reader hear my voice at all. Mm. I think, you know, sort of most poets, I think, would agree that the object of the exercise is to get the poem from your brain into someone else's, you know, yeah. You want folk to see themselves in it too.
But I could see as we were listening, because we, most of us, weren't aware of exactly what word was coming next, we didn't have the poem in front of us, it was wonderful to have you release each word in the way you wanted it to be released. At just the right moment, you turned the corner of the line at the right time with the right kind of intonation. That's the impression I got anyway. It was a really beautiful reading.
Yeah, no, I mean, the only worry I always have is, you know, sort of, because I don't think... the poet has the sort of right, the definitive right of interpretation, you know, so so other people might rightly choose to read it differently, you know. So you don't want to be tyrannical and insisting on your own way of reading it, you know.
Yes, yes. I'm going to, for my next question, ask one you've probably been asked many times before. You offered us some sonnets, and a lot of your work is heavily structured, metrical, rhyme, etc. That is possibly not typical of how people might be writing poetry at this moment in time, but to my mind, you seem to have got more and more concerned to give yourself those structures and those demands upon language. Could you say a little bit about why that is the process you put yourself through?
I think I sort of, you know, we've been thinking about Frost a lot this week for obvious reasons, you know, and Frost always used to say, you know, you know, no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. And I think that, you know, unless I can surprise myself in the course of writing the poem, no one else will be either. Which is to say that if I go in knowing what I'm going to write about, or if I have a... What I've been saying in the workshops that we've been doing to folk all this week is that if you have a good idea for a poem, it's not... You know? Just run away, because the poem is something that you learn in the process of writing it, and I find that that form, you know, and rhyme and stuff like that prevents me from saying the thing that I first wanted to say. And the other thing that springs up from your unconscious, you know, when you're working with a rhyme or whatever, is always more interesting and usually better than the thing you were about to insist on. So this poem about the death of your cat or whatever, you know?
Yeah, so not best thought first thought, as Ginsberg suggested.
Ginsberg was a liar.
True.
Ginsberg, they found, you know how he said that he wrote Howl in this kind of incandescent sort of, you know, moment of pure inspiration? They found the drafts. He was, he was working on that thing for months, you know.
Well, that's good to know. You heard it here first. I'm going to refer now to the memoir that you've been writing, and it's a memoir that's about, I think you're probably, are you in your early 20s when you finished a memoir? I think you've got to that point. You've just come down to London, haven't you?
It stops at the age of 20, that's
20,
right. Yeah,
20.
Yeah.
There's hardly any reference to poetry in it. I'm looking forward to the next volume, of course, because I'm interested in how you went from a person who was clearly obsessed with so many different things across that the period of, particularly from sort of 10 onwards, how that ended up releasing you as a poet, and obviously also a musician, but you know, to my mind, better known as a poet. So are you able to identify what it was in the turmoil of your first 20 years that laid the seeds for you to become a poet?
No, do you know that? I mean, I just like, you know, I'd kind of hoped in the writing of it I'd come up with something. You know, I always, it's a bit like that, you know, that Tony Harrison poem, you know, sort of, what is it, Heredity, you know? Yeah. You became a poet's a mystery. Wherever did you get your talent from? Yeah. I say, I had two uncles, Joe and Harry. One was a stammerer, the other dumb. And I think there may have been something about that working class chip on your shoulder of being embarrassed into articulacy. So there was that, I think. But on the other hand, I was surprised, actually. I mentioned it in the book. There is one mention of it. And I've got, I think you kind of, you know what you're going to do. I'm not a fatalist, but I think there's something karmic going on, you know. And my dad found a wee book in the loft a few years ago, and it was a story and picture thing that I'd done at the school when I was about six. And my story was, and there was a picture of Robert Burns, who's in Dundee City Centre, you know, so with his ear bent to the angels, where he has his big quill. You know, and the way poets work, you know.
Yeah, naturally, yeah.
And under it I'd written, when I grow up, I am going to be a peot and write peotry, you know. And then promptly forgot about it for maybe 15 years, and it just never occurred to me again. I thought, well, where the hell did that come from, you know? So I think sometimes you kind of know, but you're just waiting for the right planets to come into the right alignment, or the right series of crises to stack up, or the right influences to come along, you know, just to trigger it. But the trigger might not have happened, you know?
Yeah. And in the book, and in the book of poems, The Arctic, your father looms large, of course, and I had the sense that so much of what you're about was a response, a reaction to your troubled relationship with him, and almost your articulacy as a poet was a reaction to his being inarticulate, good on the guitar, but not articulate when you talk about him in the book of having a stammer and trying to make small talk with your friends, but not. Are you conscious
that he is with you when you're writing in some way? But, and indeed, I'm rambling a bit. Answer that question first, and then I'll ask another one.
Well, I feel I should be paying you for this session, Jonathan. Actually, it hadn't occurred to me. It's actually the most coherent explanation that I've heard. You know, just I think that's true. I was mortally embarrassed by my father because I over-identified with him, because I loved him so much. Yeah. And I wanted him to do better. And he was always trying to break out of this terminal self-conscious shyness by forcing himself to speak in public. The bravest thing that he did was stand up in people and play solo and sing, and he was very good at that. Mm. But as a speaker, you know, I was just embarrassed for him. The way you are when you project onto people, and it's really you. You know, so I think that's right. I think it may be an attempt to overcome his shyness for him at some level.
And you don't mention it in either of the two books, No Course Do, but I'd be interested in knowing how your family felt about your poetry, because it seems so removed from growing up in Dundee and their cultural references, which were about, you know, folk music and the stuff you talk about. Were they astonished? Did they expect you to do this? Did they move towards it or move away from it?
They were proud, but maybe not sure what they were proud of. I mean, but my mum would be proud if I was sitting up here eating a bowl of custard. She'd think it was marvellous, you know. She was sitting there taking pictures. but they were confused by it, you know, and it's, you know, funny. It's funny to come back to Harrison again, but it's weird that, on the one hand, you're trying to sort of give a voice, you know, to the people that you came from, but you end up speaking in a mode that they can't parse or understand, you know. It's because you've made yourself to some degree articulate. So they don't really. My brother reads, and my brother reads my stuff, but the rest of the family are proud without really.
Pleased you're doing it, but
But what is it you're doing?
Yeah, they're poetry curious, but not non-combatants.
I think my mom's been waiting for years for me to get a real job, still obtains, sadly.
Yes. You read a couple of very short poems. Oh, no, you read, I think, one very short poem, four lines, I think. That, again, is quite unusual. My theory is, of course, that, you know, our means of sharing text is such that people don't have any resistance to writing long poems, so they write very long poems. But you have some very short poems, very powerful. Are you conscious of trying to squeeze things into a small space to give impact and to make it easy for us, the listener and reader?
Yeah, I think it's to do with, memorability, and I think, you know, sort of there are certain things that are, if you believe in poetry as a means of sort of commemoration and memorialization, you know, and that's why it has this kind of default elegiac tone, even when you're writing about happy things. I think there are certain things that are at a premium. Originality, is obviously one of them, and I think often brevity is another. So I think there seems to be no merit in making a poem any longer than it needs to be, you know. Yeah. But it's also, it means that you don't say things that have got nothing to do with what you're talking about. You know, if you say that I have to do this in 8 lines, then the superfluous stuff has to get kicked out, I think.
Yeah. I'm leafing through the book because I wanted to reference the Alexandrian Library, Part 4, which are, well, do you want to tell us about those poems and about the sequence that you're writing through a series of books? I think they're very...
Very
moving and disturbing because of what you're alluding to.
Oh, well, it's kind of you. In this book, it's about I don't know what the hell the Alexandrian Library is. It started as a daft conceit in my first book, which is a slight juvenilia from this distance, a book called Nil Nil, and I wrote a long poem in triple meter, you know, the one that goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and you can't stop the line, you know, sort of, it just keeps going. It's like getting on a horse. It's just, you know, it's easy to write long poems. And I think in my mind, in my stupid mind at the time, I was trying to write some metaphysics of the imagination or something. But, you know, gradually over the years, I would do one a book, and I stopped about 20 years ago with this sequence, and turned it to different purposes. But you know, just I guess it was my state of the nation address to myself, you know. It was this big, stupid poem that I put in the book, and I thought, well, that's enough of that. And then this book, it came clumping back again. I could hear the gallop of hooves in the distance, and I thought, what could that be? And it was that bloody poem again, you know? So I ended up writing another installment, but this time it's about convergent apocalypses. Mm-hmm. And it ends up in the Arctic Bar in Dundee, which is a real place. It's an old whaler pub in Dundee. where there's a bit of a Roman road down in the cellar, and that becomes the kind of scriptorium where people try to reconstruct what they can remember, to be passed on to, the future as an archive. But it's about, the bomb goes off, there's zombies, there's another plague, much worse than COVID. Something else happens, it's terrible.
You're on top of Ben Nevis at one point.
Top of Ben Nevis, and there's the various climate change disasters. But it's all drawn from stuff. It sounds like a really stupid and over-elaborate conceit, because it is. But there was stuff drawn from, what's that great collaborative website where you can do real science? It's like a community science project.
Does anybody know?
It has the word zoo at the start, and I'm getting old, I can't remember. Okay. Have you done any of this? It's a huge citizen science project, Zooniverse. The Zooniverse, if you look it up, it's a citizen science thing, and you can look for quasars, and you can do work on old kind of whaling logs to look for changes in ice patterns, from 100 years ago to establish, changes in climate.
So you're contributing
climate.
to
So it's about why they were still persisting in the communal enterprise, I think, when it's clearly too late, to do anything but drink. But yeah. That's the conceit.
A final question for me before we ask you to share some poems for us. You said those poems are kind of clumping back into your life again, and you've alluded to the fact that when you're writing, you don't know what you're going to say necessarily. The form is going to release that in some way. Looking forward to future books, do you have a sense already of what the next book might be, how it might shape itself? Or are you, after this book's been published, do you give yourself a pause, do you give yourself a number of years to lie fallow until enough?
It's worse than that, it just dies, it just disappears like that. Right. And it's like a comet, and you think, that's not coming back, Right. And between books, I can go 3 years easily and not write a line of verse at all, and have to find other things to do. But it's so I'm at that stage of post book, it's not even doldrums, there's not even any sea I have a doldrum on,
Does that unnerve you or frustrate you?
It used to terrify me. Yeah. It's quite funny. I had a lot of conversations with Kath Jamie about this, because Kath suffers the same thing to the nth degree. And I've always got to tell her, look, you've been through this 10 times, this thing, you thinking you'll never write another poem again, Yeah. But I do it myself, and I've sent my book out on occasions to folks saying, this is my last book. I'd like to say, it's like, Sinatra's last tour.
Yeah.
This is my last book. I just want you to have this because I'm not going to write again after this. Yeah. And it's just nonsense.
It's a rare unsigned.
I think you have to convince yourself just to go scorched earth, I think. Yeah.
It gives you time for other things, I imagine. This is really my final question. When you're not writing poetry, I'm intrigued to know, are you just staring at the middle distance, or are you thinking, I'll do some gardening, or I'll read the Racing Post and lay some bets? What is there something else that attracts you when you're not involved in the process of poetry?
I love sitting in the shed watching somebody else do the garden, if that's a hobby. I'm writing more prose. I write sort of criticism and some sort of theory and stuff like that. But mostly I play my guitar. And I've been playing a lot more music in the last few years, so that's it. I used to do that for a living, and that's it, and that seems to be coming back again. It's now that I don't have a job anymore, having yielded my two legitimate sources of employment.
Yeah. I haven't mentioned, actually, your books about poems and poetry and so on, which are really formidable pieces of work and lots of extraordinary thinking going on, particularly in the poem, book you published a few years ago. It's a comfort to me that people like you are still taking a step back and saying, what actually is this all about? Let's not just assume we know what we're doing, let's actually try and work through what's happening here.
I think it's increasingly clear that we don't know what we're doing.
No, that's true.
And I think that'll always be there as an
inspiration. Well, the older we get, the more we realise how
the greater the depth of your ignorance, in my case.
Well, I run a well-timed event. It's 6:35, so it's time for you to read some more poems, if you'd be so kind. And then we'll have some audience questions afterwards, so do be thinking of them. Otherwise, I'll just have to talk to Donald about the weather.
Sorry, I just drank your water. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I don't mind. As I said earlier, it's perfectly pure.
If you don't mind, actually, I'll read one poem from the previous book. Which came out right at the start of the pandemic. So it was kind of published in a well, just like sort of the lockdown, I think, was the day after publication date. So great, So I wasn't able to read from it much at the time. Maybe that was a good thing. It's a rather strange book called Zonal, and it's sort of an experiment in kind of, you know, sort of autofiction. It's like it's the poems in here are sort of about my life, ish, but they're looked at through the lens of the first season of The Twilight Zone. You know the TV series. If you've seen any of that, it's really strange. Especially the episodes written by Rod Serling, who's a sort of genius, and all those episodes are based on a really simple conceit, where something goes wrong in the laws of nature. Just one little tweak happens to natural law, and I think that, you know, sort of when you get older, that sort of thing seems to happen more frequently. You know, the first time you're bereaved and you lose someone you love, it's like something's gone wrong. It's like, you know, sort of, it's like the laws haven't been obeyed, and you hadn't realised that people could disappear. So I've grafted this book onto The Twilight Zone. But I'll just read one poem. And I always wanted to write, I've been accused of being a bit morbid in the past, so I always wanted to write a poem just called Death. So I did, Death. And this is about death, and death's got a rubbish job. And we should have some sympathy. Death. His trick, by which I mean the way he'd convince you of his earnestness, was to actualize at some random and unpredictable post, unruffled, immaculate, like he'd been there all along, vaping at the turn of the stairs, taking a leak in the adjacent stall, or turning round from the seat in front in the empty matinee, saying, "Come on, we've been through this." And again, I'd get up and leave and mutter, "I'm not ready yet." And he'd say, "Okay, bud, and see you tonight," knowing we all got worn down by this in the end. Before they kicked me upstairs, I used to work in sales. I still have a case of free samples and an eye for an easy mark. One day, he was working through some genre cliches to keep himself amused, and I was closing the bathroom cabinet when I saw him at my shoulder. I shrieked. He cracked up laughing. I swung round, and we fell into the usual threadbare exchange. But I caught him, running the back of his hand across my Pima cotton towels, and stick a sidelong look at my new sonic toothbrush, with more than just a casual interest. I noticed his Prada suit was a size too large, and his floral tea cologne was Tommy Girl, though it smelled pretty good on him. And then I really saw it, his weakness. I said, look, I'll do you a deal. No deals, he says, you know that. Hear me out, I say, it's legit. Give me another 20 years, and I'll kit you out. I'll be your go-to guy. I'm serious, knock down rates. He said nothing, but the sweat was forming on his upper lip and brow. So I got out my case, and I did my old routine. I told him I'm practically giving this stuff away, though it was tough to see him so easily played, so easily reduced, so worried and frantic. Me pulling out one thing after another, him suddenly wondering if he could afford it all, patting his pockets, wondering if I took plastic, wondering if he had plastic, what plastic even was. His arms full of all the cool new things that he wanted, a black fedora, a snakeskin belt, the silk tie with a Mondrian design. Then realizing he was technically neither salaried nor self-employed, a slave to his work, he always thought, but really just a slave, hand to mouth, hardly ever in the same town two nights in a row, sleeping on couches between gigs, everything he wore lifted from the closets of the dead, everything he ate, whatever the dead had left uneaten on the stove after he'd walked him to the car. All he wanted was a night off, a table at Cleo's so he could work through the card and then go home to his own shit, some old jazz on vinyl, a valve amplifier, a good espresso machine, and a workout bike, and maybe wife and kids too in time. But whenever he thought of them, or rather what they'd talk about round the big TV, or the kitchen table as he made his famous chili, or the school gate after hockey practice, all he could ever think of was him delivering the bad news, as usual, the worst. "Daddy, what do you mean I must leave with you now?" Don't think for a second that death loves his work. Even though I couldn't stop, we both knew there was no way he could pay for any of this stuff. I was holding back the tears for him. Who wants to see their own death fall to such a two-bit hustle? In the end, I gave up. I hugged him. I said, it's okay, I'll go with you. Just give me five to get some things and say goodbye to folks. And he was fine with that, and so innocently grateful when I really did come back, carrying a near-new pair of brogues, a couple of good shirts, and a nice blue jacket that I reckoned would fit him well. And I could see in his eyes that over the years he'd lost more than a few of us this way, to this old play, and each of us had cost him like a life. Hi, Nathan. I'm not standing here reading these poems to myself, I should say. It's just like this, just in case it looks like that. I witnessed that once at a reading, and it was Sorley MacLean, the great Gaelic poet, and Norman MacCaig. And Norman was sitting in the front row, and Sorley was very slow in his old Gaelic way, and taken forever to find his poem. And Norman stage whispered, "You're supposed to read them aloud." I was asked to write an inspirational poem. I shouldn't laugh at my own joke, should I? I was asked to write an inspirational poem, you know, sort of along the lines of Rilke's letters to a young poet. So I wrote this. And then I thought, I can't possibly put my name to this. So I did what I usually do and pretended it was by somebody else. So this is the guy that I wheel out for these occasions. He's a non-existent Slovakian poet called Ladislav Skala. But this is my words of encouragement for a young poet today. Letter to a young poet. We too thought our contemporaries were doing vital work. We'd quote each other in our epigraphs as if we were Krasko. Because the Writers' Union had decreed a cult of youth, we were awarded the greatest prizes for our very first books. We denounced the old and shamed them for their politics. In our 40s, half of us had given up and now did other things. In our 50s, there were maybe 10 of us left standing, read only by each other and living off handouts from the state. By 60, we had given up on the pretense that we could understand one word of the poetry of the young. In our 70s, we wrote very little of any actual worth. And by the time we were 80, we were all dead. Go forth, young one, suitably inspired. This is my favourite story from Greek mythology, I think. And there's a lot to choose from, isn't there? But this is the marriage of Aphrodite in one telling. One version of the story unfolds pretty much like this. And there's a truth in it, I think, and it's called On Being Seen. Aphrodite inspecting her suitors on Olympus. Excuse me. Aphrodite inspecting her suitors on Olympus looks down the gilded colonnade where Apollo, Hermes, Ares, and the rest stand ready to make their case. Aphrodite, who is not just the goddess of love, but is love, sexual love, and can no more help who she is than a flower its own scent, walks naked along the line, looking up and down each perfect god in turn. Their merits, otherwise self-evident, are already well known. Each offers their gift. Forgetting that love thinks only of herself, they all give what will appear to have cost them most. Apollo, a golden lyre, tuned to the very heart song of the planets. Ares, a bow of fine silver that cannot miss its mark, and so on. Aphrodite accepts their gifts with grace and leans in to whisper in their ear the time and place of their tryst, where she can show her appreciation in private. So she goes on down the line. At the end, a good head and a half shorter than the others is Hephaestus. Hephaestus, the little smith god, brawny, paunchy, maimed, lame, ugly as sin, and covered in sweat and grime as he's just come from work down in the forges of hell. Hell his office, where all is fire and molten ore, and the clanging of great anvils and the roars of the titans he commands. He doesn't look her in the eye. She's trying to master a smile and keep a straight face. "And what do you have for me?" she says. "Little god." Hephaestus opens a grubby palm to reveal a brooch. He is a master jeweler and has fashioned for Aphrodite the perfect adornment for one whose vanity is far more pure than any mortal virtue. The brooch is worked in red gold that seems the very distillation of her fiery hair, and at the centre is an emerald cabochon that echoes her eyes to perfection. Aphrodite is moved by the gift, but still amused. "Thank you. This is perfect. It must have taken you forever." She stoops and drops her voice so the others cannot hear, as if she's already talking to one with whom she's reached an understanding. "But why in heaven's name, little brother, do you think you'd make a good husband for a girl like me?" Hephaestus draws himself upright and looks her in the eye. "I work late." Aphrodite lets her eyes close and a smile break across her face and kisses him on the brow, and to the eternal bewilderment of Apollo, Hermes, Ares and the rest, the marriage is sealed. That's a true story. It's a poem called A Winter Apple. "Here, I got you one of those you like, those bewildered late bloomers, tough and small, and sweeter than they've any right to be. As green as Eden, the red in afterthought, as if there'd been an hour left in the season to paint them all. And where the brush had swept, the snow-white fruit below is stained with pink, as if your teeth had bled from biting it." It was hard enough to body itself forth, with so few leaves to hide it from the frost, without it burning fuel on working out where its skin stopped and its flesh began. All that touched it shook its heart. It was that, or it was nothing. Take it in your pocket on your long Sunday walk to eat by the loch with that lone jackdaw only you can talk to. I make no great claims for this little thing, but I promise only good will come of it. I'll read two more. It's a version of a famous poem in Italian, L'Infinito by Leopardi. This is just the infinite. It's a version of that. "When I was young, I loved this lonely hill with its long windbreak that hides the last horizon. I'd lie back in the grass and stare away up into that vast supernal blue, a newest silence of no earthly kind. My heart held no fear, and it told no hour. And when the wind went sifting through the leaves like so much breathing in an empty room, I'd think on how the precincts of the dead are haunted by the living, how the present is veined with every life it ushers through. The ocean never knew a sweeter shipwreck than my own drowning in that endlessness." And I'll finish off with the last poem in the book, which is called August. In one of my previous lives, there was a plum tree in the garden that had some kind of fit one year. Very strange. August. "Did someone give the tree the magic words? One week of sun, and suddenly great bunches of ochre and orange drupes hung from the branches, so sweet already half were holed by birds, or stuck with wasps, too loaded to shoo off. But half of them were perfect and pristine, polished eggs of sunstone and citrine, and half was 40 times more than enough. What we couldn't eat, we stoned and froze, or did until the freezer wouldn't close, or left out on the wall for passing folk to sticky their hands with on their evening walk. The plum tree's birthdays had all come at once. But obviously, this is a circumstance suboptimal for plum trees as for men, and it never really fruited right again. By winter, you and I were good as done. I crept round like a target of the state, killing lights and listening for the gate, while you cut down the birches for the sun and rued it in an instant, guessing right that when the kids got back from school, they'd cry to see the windows full of empty sky. You had to draw the blinds till it was night. But that one summer held us in its blaze, the spirals turning slow as galaxies in the boys' gold crowns, while high above their heads the girls leapt in the boughs like plum tree dryads, and the half-mad tree sowed fruit along its spreading arms, drunk as a father at a wedding, refilling and refilling his own cup, and not giving a damn if it could keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Don. That was, again, a really superb reading, and lovely to finish the poetry reading on that final poem. We now have 7 or 8 minutes for some questions from the audience. We're in England, so I expect an embarrassed silence, but if somebody would like to break that silence, we may have a roving mic. We do have somebody with a question, and a roving mic is heading slowly towards you. A person who first put the hand up and then the gentleman just behind. So we'll hear the first question, if we may. Thank you.
Who inspired you to start writing poetry?
There was actually, yeah, I think I mentioned him earlier, the poet Tony Harrison. And he was one of the first poets to make an impact on the TV. And what happened was I'd moved down to London, and I was sitting in the world's worst bedsit in Tottenham with the world's worst television, which was a black and white TV with a smoked glass front. So it was like a seance, you know. It was a terrible television. And then one night there was a programme, and Tony Harrison was reading poems in a pub. It was poems I realised later from a book called Continuous, which were elegies for his mother and father. And they were also about sort of, you know, articulacy and coming from a working class background, you know, and just like, and trying to communicate with your mum and dad, you know, and the separation that sometimes one's education puts between the people that you love the most. And it was the first time I got poetry, and I thought, oh, hang on a minute, this is great. And then a camera pans around the room, and there's all these weeping bikers and sobbing women, and I thought, This is the life for me. So I rushed out, but I didn't think about writing, to be honest. I got Tony's book, so I sort of devoured that, and I thought, I really like writing, reading poetry. So that came first, and then I sort of started reading Seamus and the Irish poets, and then something happened. Then I had something important to say to a woman, a letter of apology that I had to write, and only verse would do. So I sat up night after night writing this long thing in rhyming couplets for some reason. I think in imitation of Tony Harrison, you know. And this went on for months. At the end of which, I'd probably forgotten the addressee and was more concerned with the poem. So that's it. So I can blame Tony for all that. I blamed him to his face.
Thank you very much for that question. Lovely answer. The microphone's going to go across to our next questioner. And here it comes. Thank you.
Thank you, Don, for some wonderful poetry. And I particularly was taken by your early sonnets and your occasional going off into rhyme, because I think you may remember earlier today I revealed to you that some years ago in Ledbury, on a one-to-one, you told me to push rhyming aside, which I've done for years and years. But what you've taught me this evening is that there's a whole range of response to ideas that come into your head. And thank you very much for a wonderful poetry reading. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. My favourite kind of question.
Well, and we now have a question from the wider world via the internet.
We do. We've got a couple, actually.
Okay.
So Alan Lloyd has made a really interesting observation around the Aberdeen Chrysanthemum and Dahlia Society. Ledbury Poetry Festival, in its early days, apparently received inquiries about the Ledbury Poultry Festival and the Ledbury Pottery Festival. But I wanted to ask, having retired from Picador Poetry as editor last year after 25 magnificent years, do you miss it, Don?
No. Ah.
Great question, great answer. Do you want to expand on that answer at all?
Not really. No, I mean, it's just like, yeah, I miss the authors, sort of, I really do, but I'm a coward and I hate turning folk down. And I hated the rejection part of it, sort of. I liked all the other stuff, but there are parts of it that are hard, And also, it was a kind of interesting job, and people tend not to appreciate, sort of where some, publishers might have. This sounds like a bitch, this thing, but it's where some publishers might have grants and Arts Council grants. I had accountants, so just keeping the show on the road was my main sort of aim in the last 15 years or so. Which was a sort of slightly bumpy time in poetry publishing, especially around 15 years ago. So keeping the ship afloat was what I was primarily concerned with. So I don't miss the stress, sort of the business side of things, but I do miss the editing and the authors. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And your second question, I think?
Second question from Paul Newman. When writing, where does a poem start, or what do you start with?
I think I mentioned if I get a good idea for a poem, I run away. I've learnt that, so I can cut out the middleman now, and I can think straight into the bin sometimes, without... hitting the page at all. So that's good. So that saves time. I think you get better at recognising duff poems much earlier in their creation. Whereas before, at the start, I'd have to finish them. 20 years ago, I'd have to get halfway through. Now I don't start at all. Sometimes that leads to not writing anything. But it's I think a lot of other poets would confirm this. But you just get a mad obsession that two things go together and you don't know how, and the poem's the only way of working out how. Somebody says something that changes in context, or that thing relates to that event somehow and you can't say how. So I think, someone like Michael Longley would say a poem needs a sperm and an egg, and it's a yin and yang, and it's all about love, and something has to, there has to be a generative proposition that you can't let go of, that only a poem will allow you to work out. Do you know what I mean? So it's there's a certain kind of thought that only a poem can pursue, and you learn to recognise that kind of thought. And it usually just itches you, it's just like, until you have to do something about it. But good ideas are bad, so.
And we have time for one final question just over here in the audience in Ledbury.
Don, given your response to the last question about being an editor, and in the light of the next event in the Burgage Hall this evening, I believe you were Clive James's editor. I wondered if you'd just like a few comments about your relationship with Clive.
Sorry, Mr. Editor.
Were you Clive James's editor?
Yeah.
And what was that like?
It was as good as you might think. It was an absolute gift. And he was as good company as you could have dreamt or hoped him to be. It was his poetry editor, it was like that. There is a certain kind of Australian of a certain generation where it was just an education to stand next to them for a while. Les Murray was the same, Peter Porter was the same, Clive was the same, it's just like, I think I got a lot more out of our editorial sessions than he did, He was quite easy to edit. I just go, Clive, lose the first two stanzas, you're just clearing your throat. And then it would be fine, But yeah, he's I should say about Clive, since we're here, he's the most marvelously underrated poetry critic. He's a brilliant critic of poetry, and he's not valued in the UK at all. They take him seriously in the States, you know, but because we still tend to think of Clive as that boy from the telly, you know, we don't take his criticism as seriously. But if you haven't got, I'm sure you've read some of his poems, but please read A Poetry Notebook, which is a beautiful, and his book on Larkin, which is wonderful.
Well, thank you very much for that question, and thank you, Don, for your wonderful answer. I'm sorry to say our time draws to a close. So my thanks both to the audience here in Ledbury and to those in the wider world, particularly for the very high quality of questions we've had. Thank you very much.
Thank you. But you need a bigger lapel.